Hello and welcome to the latest Mies podcast. We're recording this on Monday, the 4th of July. I'm James Cockayne, Mies' managing editor, and I'm joined today by our Gulf editor, Jamie Ingram. We're going to kick off today's discussion by Jamie talking about OPEC policy and global oil supply and demand, which has been the subject of several excellent recent Mies analysis pieces, and I'm sure many more to come. And then we'll change gear a bit, and Jamie's going to quiz me about a lengthy analysis piece I did in the latest Mies on Syria, in particular the chances of a proposed oil for aid policy for Syria gaining traction. Jamie, on OPEC, was there any excitement at the OPEC Plus meeting last week? Do we expect that Joe Biden's planned trip to Saudi Arabia later this month will lead to any changes in policy, especially as this comes just before the current OPEC Plus agreement comes to an end at the end of August?
Excitement? No, I can't say that there was any excitement last week. Frankly, it was all a little bit dull, pretty quick again, as they have been all the meetings in recent months. Essentially, all that they did was they ratified the agreement from the previous meeting so that from August, they will bring online the final increment from the big 9.7 million barrel a day cuts that began way back in May 2020. So more than two years ago. So we're kind of reaching the end of the road on that one. But the issue, of course, is that everybody wants them to do a little bit more. And from speaking to delegates at the talks, it seems as if there was no discussions about what they're going to do beyond August. So, you know, whether they're going to push beyond the baselines that were initially set. So that should come up when they next meet on the 3rd of August. So that if you're looking for any excitement, things could get a little bit tasty at that meeting. But before that, of course, we had the big trip from US President Joe Biden over to the region in general, but particularly of note is 15th and 16th of July when he's going to be in Saudi Arabia. He's made it very clear that he will indeed be asking producers in general. He didn't want to name any particular names. I think everybody knows precisely who he's talking about, Saudi Arabia and the UAE. But yeah, he's going to be asking producers to increase production while he is in Jeddah. So, you know, where do we stand now? When OPEC met, they looked at the, you know, a market report that was prepared for them by the Secretariat. That pointed to production for the whole OPEC Plus group being around 2.7 million barrels a day below intended levels in May. Frankly, that gap's only going to widen over the next couple of months. So whichever way you slice it, even when taking into account kind of some of the inflated baselines that were agreed upon when they started this process, you know, there's a lot of production that's still not able to get to market for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, it's a complex picture. Could you give us a bit more detail on, I mean, obviously you're saying that OPEC Plus is producing well below their planned levels, 2.7 million barrels a day below. I mean, this is partly, like you say, because some producers can't produce more, but it's also in part, there's the parallel thing that certain producers are still not producing as much as they could. I think our opinion is that really it's just Saudi Arabia and the UAE that have spare capacity that they could lead them to increase output over the coming months. Is that correct?
Yeah, so certainly the big issues as far as OPEC Plus production lagging behind intended levels, I'd say there's two things there. One is sanctions. Iran, Venezuela, obviously under direct sanctions from the US, and then whether it's voluntary, you want to call them voluntary sanctions or whatever, you know, Russian production has dropped quite markedly, not as much as some said, but it's down a lot since the Ukraine invasion. And then the other issue is low investment in a number of producers. So Angola, Nigeria, Algeria to some extent, basically they've suffered from years of low prices. That's taking its toll as they've been not been able to invest that into maintaining production capacity. So they've really been increasingly falling off the pace of production ramp-ups since even before the turn of the year. Yeah, Saudi Arabia and the UAE, they have the production capacity to increase production, but they are limited by the terms of the current OPEC Plus agreement, which says, no, this is your limit, even though you can go above that. And OPEC politics means that they can't basically take someone else's share, as it would be perceived as by a number of other members. So, yeah, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, they're the only guys with the ability to increase production. But, you know, if let me plug our OPEC monthly assessment that we will be coming out with in the issue this week. We're kind of seeing even Saudi Arabia and the UAE starting to fall off the pace a little bit. Doesn't mean that they can't increase. It's just that, you know, they have been continuously increasing for a long time now. They are basically producing at or near levels that they've never sustained for any lengthy period of time previously. So it's going to be a slow process.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, maybe a subject for another podcast, but, you know, there's been a lot of debate about Saudi Arabia's claimed 12 million barrels a day production capacity. Well, even that's Aramco, right? Saudi Arabia that's should Aramco, be a bit yeah. more. Yeah. So,
yeah. And some people put it at, you know, around 12.25 for Saudi Arabia as a whole. I think that's very exaggerated because that, let's not go into it too much, but yeah, that suggests 500,000 barrels a day from the neutral zone, which I think is not achievable at the moment, certainly.
And how does OPEC's relations with Russia complicate things going forward?
That's a good question. They managed to come to an agreement to, you know, to change the terms slightly when they met last month. They did accelerate the tapering of the production cuts. So that was something that Russia did agree to. I think that it's clear that OPEC, they put a lot of effort into bringing Russia into the alliance, as it were. So that was formalized in 2016, took effect in 2017, and they're not willing to ditch that just yet. Even if, you know, frankly, Russia is not the oil market player that it was back then. You know, all the Western firms are leaving the Russian upstream now. Investment, difficult to get that there. So the perception is that Russian production capacity will be on a downwards trend for years to come now. So I think that they're not going to be that same influential figure that can ramp up and down as required that they were a few years ago. But as I say, still very much key for OPEC to maintain what is still one of the world's largest producers as part of their pact.
Sure. And though, like you say, the long-term outlook for Russia doesn't look good, over the short term, certainly last month, this month, maybe next month, it seems like Russian production is maybe a bit higher than a lot of people thought it might have been. I seem to recall an IEA report a few months back when sanctions first started was predicting that output might be down by, say, 3 million barrels a day, something of that magnitude by now. Certainly a lot less than that. Anyway, talking about Biden visiting the Gulf, I mean, presumably he's not going to want more Russian output, but where else can he secure extra supplies from? Is it just Saudi and the UAE? Is there any other country that might have a bit of extra oil up their sleeve somewhere?
Yeah, I mean, it's true what you say about Russia. I would probably just point out as well that, you know, you've got EU sanctions on shipping insurance kicking in later this year. So, you know, that's kind of seen as the big game changer when it comes to future near-term Russian outlook. When it comes to the Biden visit, I think that, you know, the big OPEC Gulf producers and the USA, they all want to come out of the next few weeks demonstrating the same thing, which is that the US and Saudi Arabia and the UAE, they're on the same page and they're cooperating in stabilizing the market. You know, that the optics of that, the market sentiment goes a long way towards reducing volatility, goes the theory, even more so than any actual meaningful impact on fundamentals. So the problem here is that Saudi Arabia and the UAE, a big concern of theirs is that the market will be very exposed, is quite exposed at the moment, frankly, due to a lack of spare capacity. If an agreement is put in place that enables them to produce even above their August allocations, that strips away further spare capacity. And the risk is that in the event of, you know, let's say a big outage in, I don't know, Libya, for instance, the market, crazy volatility, that's very damaging. So that's their big concern. So when it comes to a possible compromise that keeps most parties fairly happy, my mind goes back to June 2018, when OPEC Plus switched from individual quotas to a temporary group ceiling. So, you know, essentially, instead of saying Saudi Arabia, its capacity, you know, its allocation increases to 11.5 million barrels a day, and UAE goes up to 4 million barrels a day. You know, this would be that OPEC Plus as a whole, its production allocation is X. You know, let's say that it's the same as the total of all the baselines, give or take a little bit, because that too often the individual country allocations, they get perceived as being targets, and then when you fail to hit targets, that panics the market. So for this, it would give Biden, he would be able to spin it in one way that OPEC Plus has the flexibility to increase production if required, where Saudi Arabia and the UAE, they wouldn't be baggaged with this this unwieldy kind of a production, what would be perceived as a production target by many. So that gives them the flexibility to just say, no, for now, we're not going to increase, or we're going to increase next month, but then we're going to bring production down for 2 months after that, that kind of thing. So, and then for internal OPEC Plus politics, you kind of move away from that, those accusations from, let's say, Nigeria, that someone else is stealing their allocation. It, you know, Saudi Arabia can say, okay, we're going to increase production by 200,000 barrels a day next month. And then Nigeria, if you bring your production up by 200,000 barrels a day, then we'll dial back down to where we were previously. So yeah, that's kind of where I see it with OPEC, with OPEC Plus. Now, as you kind of said in the introduction, one producer that's not really mentioned is Syria, for fairly obvious reasons. And you know, last week you did write a very interesting piece, kind of looking at one of the legacy producers there, Gulf Sands, and proposals for what could be labeled a Syria oil food program. Now, kind of even if that's all above board, I think that it's fair to say that oil for food is going to ring a lot of alarm bells, given memories of previous Iraq scandals. So, you know, what's the prospects for this going ahead? And is there any prospect of other firms with Syrian assets coming on board such a scheme?
Thanks, Jamie. Yeah, for sure. Researching this story was interesting. You know, it enabled me to be a bit nerdy and do a lot of digging and covering lots of details. And it was interesting, you know, I found some links between past scandals related to the Iraq program you mentioned, and certainly the antecedents of Gulf Sands in Syria. Now, as you know, this company, Gulf Sands, has what you could say is a checkered history. And often when you're researching stories, sometimes the most interesting ones to look into are the ones with small firms, with convoluted relations. And sometimes you do some digging and it ends up being a bit anticlimactic. You think, well, the numbers are very small. It's going to offend a lot of people. Is it really worth the hassle? Can we justify running this, you know? However, in this instance, it was interesting because it was Gulf Sands who approached me about the story. Well, I'll get onto that in a second, but some background. Syria, when war kicked off there in 2011, was producing around 400,000 barrels a day. So, I mean, it wasn't Kuwait, right? But it's not nothing either. You know, this is much, much more than Tunisia, for example. It's 2/3 of the output of Egypt. So it's not nothing. There were five foreign companies operating oil and gas assets there. The two biggies were Shell and Total. Also, Canada's Suncor, which is a big player, albeit mostly in oil shale in Canada. And also Croatia's Ina, which is a smaller tier firm that's, I think, around 50% owned by Hungary's MOL. And finally, by far the smallest, this company, Gulf Sands, that was at least the instigator of the story in the latest Mies. Now, there's a lot of detail, and I'm going to keep saying for the detail, read the story. But basically, in contrast to the other four companies who long ago, officially at least, wrote off their Syria assets and say very little about them, for Gulf Sands, the strategy has been to conserve cash as much as possible and hope for a return. To the extent that they diversified after 2011, this has been reversed. And the key thing now is just to keep costs as low as possible. So they've cut costs to around $2 million a year. And it's quite interesting speaking to the managing director. They don't even have their own office space anymore in London. They operate out of shared offices. The reason that they think this is worthwhile, even though it might seem somewhat far-fetched that they're going to get to return to their Syria assets and things are going to go back to normal, is that if you look at the risk and reward calculus, their expenditure is around $2 million a year, but the upside's massive. China Sinochem paid almost $900 million. So, you know, what's that? Nearly 500 times $2 million, right? So China Sinochem paid almost $900 million for the other 50% of the Gulf Sands concession back in 2009. So even if you think it's not worth anything like that now, it's certainly worth paying $2 million a year to keep things ticking over if the upside is in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Gulf Sands, for its part, reckons the concession could produce up to 100,000 barrels a day. Actual output was 24,000 pre-war, but it was ramping up. They had plans to produce a lot more.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you know, clearly when we're talking now on $100 plus barrel, you know, $100 barrel a day, let me start again, $100 oil price environment, that does go a long way.
Well, yeah, I mean, 100,000 barrels a day, $100 a barrel is $10 million a day, isn't it? You know, so it's five times their current annual, not that they net all of that, obviously, but, you know, that's five times their current annual outgoings.
Yeah, so you can certainly see why they where the value is for them. It's interesting that they approach you. So clearly they're looking to publicize this. You know, this isn't some shady backroom deal that they're trying to broker here. So, you know, perhaps you can go into the details of what exactly this oil for aid proposal is that they're making.
Yeah, so, I mean, Gulf Sands, you know, read our story. We have lots of detail on the background to Gulf Sands. And, you know, I don't think anyone would deny there's some shady characters in the past. But I'm not trying to claim that there's anything shady about them at the present. And certainly their official position is very straight down the line that they're a UK-registered company, UK-based company. They're going to comply with all sanctions. They're going to do everything above the board. So under this plan, Gulf Sands and other foreign producers would return to their fields, and then the Syrian state's share of proceeds from the output would go to a UN-administered humanitarian fund. The Gulf Sands MD, John Bell, who I spoke to, sold the plans as, well, was trying to sell the plans as a win-win-win for the Kurds. So the fields are in the far northeast of Syria in Kurdish-controlled areas, which is a complicating factor, you could say. So it'd be a win-win-win for the Kurds, for Damascus, and for the Syrian people as well. And like I say, he's very insistent that any plans will only happen if they can be done fully in line with international sanctions on Syria.
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, international sanctions on Syria, they're a big issue. So, you know, what are the chances of these plans actually moving forward? And the US does seem to be casting around for any potential source of, you know, additional global oil supply at the moment. But is this realistic?
Yeah, well, I think it's ambitious, but you can see why they want to give it a push at the moment, because, you know, it is a bit the zeitgeist to find any, you know, any bit of oil behind the sofa. I'd say the key problem is that it's Gulf Sands, the company at the moment that's pushing it. I mean, they have got a complicated history. A big win for them is if Total or Shell would pick up the plans and run with them. I think, you know, if you had Total and Shell behind them, maybe the, you know, French Foreign Ministry as well as the British Foreign Office, that sort of thing, you could see it getting some traction. At the moment, it's difficult. To date, you know, they haven't had much interest. We spoke to some diplomatic sources. We also spoke to all the other, well, tried to speak, got in touch with, let's say, all the other firms with assets in Syria, and none would say anything beyond basic pro forma stuff from their annual reports. You know, we're committed to international sanctions, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Certainly not. I guess the problem is that, you know, Total and Shell, they have much bigger fish to fry rather than getting embroiled, you know, even if, you know, they were willing to risk being embroiled in something like this, Syria is not where they want to be focusing their investments anyway. In the energy transition, you've got to be more careful where you throw money around.
For sure. And like I said, Gulf Sands has got a bit of a checkered history, and you can see why maybe this might put off some other companies or diplomats from associating with them. Just to give a bit of the background. So when we've written about Gulf Sands in the past, it was partly to say that they had a bit of an in with the Assad family, because Rami Makhlouf, Bashar al-Assad's cousin, who he's since fallen out with and no longer has a stake in Gulf Sands, I better say, but he was previously a key shareholder of Gulf Sands. So, you know, in the past, when war first kicked off in Syria, it was like, oh, well, maybe this company will go back to their assets because they're having in with the Assad family. Yeah. Then there was strong rumors that the guy who then took over as Gulf Sands' lead shareholder, Mikhail Krupiev, a Russian national, there was chat that, well, maybe they've gotten in because Russia is very influential in Syria and he has links to the Kremlin. Now, we wrote this, other people wrote this. Gulf Sands weren't happy. This is one reason the MD got in touch with us to say, no, he hasn't got any links to the Kremlin. We're totally above board. We're a British company committed to all sanctions, that sort of thing. But, you know, as a result of him getting in touch, and, you know, it soon became apparent that the key reason he wanted to chat to me was to put forward this oil freight plans to see, you know, so we publicize it, which I guess he's achieved that. We are publicizing it and we'll see if it gets some traction. But also what he clearly didn't know was, you know, my background is, you know, back at the start of the 2000s, I was an oil market reporter. And one of the first things I did, I was, this was a rival company. I was reporting on the trade in Iraqi crude and speaking to the traders who were involved in what was euphemistically called surcharges on the Iraq crude oil trade and how this operates. So I wrote a lot about that back in the day, and there was some companies that were, let's say, notorious for being involved in this trade. And once I started doing some digging on Gulf Sands in Syria, some familiar names cropped up with relation to this. Now, like I say, we're not actually claiming that there's any impropriety involved in what Gulf Sands is proposing at the moment. But certainly you can see why this sort of background would be a red flag to other companies jumping on the bandwagon and getting involved. So,
and for governments providing the last thing they want is the, you know, tabloids and broadsheets, you know, flagging this up on the front page, new oil for food scandal kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure. So just to give a little bit of the detail, like I say, read the story for all the detail. But Mr. Krupiev, the current Gulf Sands key shareholder and chairman, when he first entered Syria, his key associate was a guy called Yuri Shafranik, who is a former Russian oil minister. And he was heavily implicated in corruption associated with Saddam-era Iraq oil for food via his company, Soyuz Neftegaz. He founded that company. He remains chairman of it. I was thinking of going into the detail. I don't think I'll go into all the detail. It's just it's too in the weeds. But
it's a convoluted web.
Read the story, I guess I'd say. But yeah, to repeat, there's, in terms of the current Gulf Sands management and Mr. Krupiev, I haven't got any evidence that they've done anything wrong, anything like that. We're not suggesting that. We're just saying that there's a history of associates being involved in the Iraq scandal. It doesn't look good. And you can see why, you know, for these oil freight plants to succeed, it would have to be someone else than Gulf Sands, who was the key backer of them. I mean, who knows? It could happen, like you say, you know, Biden's suddenly asking Venezuela for more oil. You know, there could be a deal with Iran, you know, although you have to say that Iran volumes are somewhat higher than Syria. But I think it's a long shot. But yeah, who knows?
Want to keep an eye on. I guess the parallel to this is, you know, well, not so much a parallel, but possibly a positive indicator for the prospects of this is this US-backed plan to export so-called Egyptian gas to Lebanon, given that the pipelines, they flow through Syria. So there has to be, even if it's not direct, there has to be some sort of engagement with Syria in order for this plan to succeed. So does that indicate that we're seeing a little bit of willingness from this US administration to handle Syria in some way?
Yeah, I mean, this, we've written some good stuff on these plans to supply gas to Lebanon, and there's been some interesting comments from Amos Hochstein. What's you know what his title is? I can't remember.
I'm not sure. I always think of him as the kind of the US government's overseas energy czar, sort of
thing. Yeah, exactly. So there's been some interesting comments. He certainly sounded positive about it, but you have to say the US has yet to sign off on these plans. So, you know, the other countries in the region have all said, oh, yeah, we're all for it. But there's two big problems so far. Firstly, they're all banking on the World Bank paying for it. And as far as I can say, tell the World Bank's actually not said anything on it officially. And secondly, they're waiting for the US to give it a sanctions waiver as regards Syria. And whilst Amos Hochstein sounded positive, I don't think that's a foregone conclusion. So, but having said that, for sure, that he has definitely said that the US is in favor of the proposals, and you would think the logical way for this to proceed would be that Syria would get some transit payment, or at the very least, there has to be the involvement of Syria. I mean, basically, the way it works is it's a swap deal involving gas being supplied to Syria, and then Syria supplies the same amount of gas to Lebanon. So it's not even like it's just gas transiting Syria. There's quite a lot of active participation needed. Yeah. So that's positive in terms of engagement with Syria. And for sure, I mean, if you look at the region, more and more Gulf countries, other regional countries are prepared to deal with Assad. I think pretty much everyone's given up on trying to remove Assad from power. So he is gradually coming in from the cold. Whether that to go back to talk of an oil for aid program, whether that's enough to for anyone to be prepared to stick their neck out for something that has the potential to be controversial, and then going beyond that, whether anyone can imagine sanctions ending, which, you know, you'd have to imagine is the target end game for the likes of Gulf Sands and other companies with suspended assets in Syria, that you'd hope for an end to sanctions at some stage. I mean, that looks a long way off.
Yeah, I guess it's another thing to watch out for during the Biden visit, because, you know, although it's labeled Egyptian gas, it's really effectively going to be Israeli gas that's being diverted. Biden's visiting Israel during the trip. Also, when he's in Saudi Arabia, you know, there'll be, you know, big GCC+3 meeting that's going to involve the UAE. They had Assad visit recently. It's going to involve Jordan. You know, they're a key part of this transit. And of course, you know, given US-Israeli relations, anything that involves Syria, I think it's going to have Israeli sign off, you know, at least some sort of shaking of hands between them and the US administration, I think. So, yeah, could be another development from that meeting.
You would think so. I mean, it's I'd advise people actually to have a read of the stories we've done about this, because it's a bit complicated to explain in a simple way. But basically, nominally, Egypt imports gas from Israel, and then Egypt sells gas to Lebanon via Syria and Jordan. And, you know, it's not explicit that effectively what's happening is some of the Israeli gas that Egypt is buying is getting diverted north to Jordan, Syria, and ultimately Lebanon. But, you know, anyone looking at the pipeline logistics, it's impossible for the gas to get there other than coming from Israel. So it'd be interesting to see whether Israel actually do come out at some stage and openly say this. You know, there have been reports in the Israeli media stating the obvious, and everyone's nominally denied it, you know. But we'll see. You know, if factions in the Israeli government or security apparatus at some stage in the future want to exert some sort of leverage over Lebanon or Syria, you would think this would be an obvious thing to flag up, you know. But we'll see going forward. It's a complicated part of the world.
Definitely.
Yeah, should we call that a deal then, Jamie? I think We normally aim for half an hour. We've been going for at least half an hour. So I think...
I think it's a good place to call it a day, yeah.
Let's call it a day. Nice speaking to you. And thanks to everyone for listening. Catch you again sometime soon.